This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, May 29th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums. The 2012 KUAF Fulbright Chamber Music Festival continues with the Italian Serenade for String Quartet, Night Piece for Flute and Strings by the American composer Arthur Foote, and Brahms Clarinet Quintet, performed by the University of Arkansas Music Department faculty and guest artists Thursday night at 7:30 at St. Paul's Episcopal Church Parish Hall in Fayetteville. Admission is free. Information available at fulbrightsummermusic.uark.edu. The 62nd Annual Opera in the Ozarks is June 22nd to July 20th at Inspiration Point near Eureka Springs. This season's productions include La Boheme, A Little Night Music, and The Magic Flute. Sunday performances will be held at the Arendt Arts Center in Bentonville on July 1st, 8th, and 15th at 4 p.m. Tickets and more information available at opera.org. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, two of the state's most read political bloggers sit down with Roby Brock from TalkBusiness.net to discuss last week's primary election in Arkansas and the general election in the fall, and how yarn, social awareness, and public displays of art can come together. Meredith Martin-Motes reports on just what a yarn bomb is. First, the National Weather Service says there is a chance for more rain in the next few days, possibly some severe weather that may move into the region between tonight and Thursday. The latest weather outlook suggests strong thunderstorms with large hail and damaging winds could move into eastern Oklahoma and western Arkansas by early tonight. The National Weather Service office in Tulsa says a March 19th storm that hit Fayetteville was a tornado. The service says an EF0 tornado, that is a twister with wind speeds up to 85 miles per hour, hit near the intersection of Old Wire and East Mission Boulevard on that date. Brad McGavick, a meteorologist with the Tulsa office, says the official designation came after on-site investigations of storm damage.
Folks from our office, folks from the Weather Service, will go out and look at the damage if they can. Next chance is they'll start gathering all the data that's associated with that day. So that may be public reports, that may be media reports that have respond or relate to this particular storm or event, includes radar data. We'll go back and look at all that. That's all archived, and we'll go back and look for that, and we'll try to piece together exactly what happened.
The official declaration that the storm was a tornado can put to rest a local legend that no tornado has ever hit the city, folklore that's been inspired by Fayetteville's hilly geography.
You know, we hear a lot of that on different towns and different locations. We'll hear people that relate, you know, the weather phenomena or lack thereof to certain geographical features or, you know, things like that. And really there's no scientific background for any of that that I know of.
The March 19th storm is blamed for damaged trees and some minor residential and business damage. Arkansas's home sales fell 10% last month, though the most recent reports indicate the average price of a home sale increased by 8%. Amy Glover-Bryan with the Arkansas Realtors Association says the cause of the shift is unknown.
That's the magic question. You know, we can speculate that it could be that the inventory, we're going through inventory. It could be, as I've heard from a number of realtors, that they are getting multiple offers on homes. And so the housing, you know, people are getting good value out of their house.
She says sales for the entire year are up slightly, about 2%, when compared to the same time last year. Visitors to downtown Fort Smith will have a dozen new opportunities to learn about the city's history. 12 plaques describing historical connections to the city were formally dedicated this morning in Fort Smith. Each of the plaques has a QR code attached that will allow visitors to learn more about each historic site by using a smartphone or other mobile device. The plaques were donated to the city. The American Bar Association is placing Arkansas at the very bottom of a list of states ranked by access to legal services for those who can't afford them. The Arkansas Access to Justice Commission is holding a conference this week to address the issue. Nathan Vandiver has this report from Little Rock.
In criminal matters, the U.S. Constitution gives those charged with a crime the right to have a lawyer represent them in court, whether they can pay or not. But if someone has an issue in civil court, like a divorce or a foreclosure, there's no guarantee of legal help. The Arkansas Access to Justice Commission is a group created by the Arkansas Supreme Court and given the task of providing all Arkansans equal access to legal help in civil court.
There's a substantial number of Arkansans who don't have access to legal help for legal matters because they don't make enough money to afford an attorney.
Amy Johnson is the executive director of the Arkansas Access to Justice Commission. She says civil legal issues affect many aspects of people's lives.
For example, you know, with the medical legal partnership that we have with Children's Hospital, you'll have a situation where a child has asthma, and you also find out that the family is living in terrible conditions. They're leasing an apartment, and the landlord won't fix the mold. And by addressing the legal issue, you can also take care of the underlying problem that's contributing to the poor health of the child.
In addition, Johnson says education and legal partnerships and discussions on how to help people who have to represent themselves in court are on the list of topics. Retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens will be the closing guest speaker at the State House Convention Center Wednesday night. Johnson says 500,000 Arkansans make incomes that would qualify them for civil legal assistance should they ever need it. While the number who need legal assistance is fewer, there is still not adequate funding to help those people. Cecile Dewan is a consumer protection attorney for the Center for Arkansas Legal Services, a group that provides civil legal assistance to those who can't afford it. She says educating Arkansans about their rights and the resources they can access is a big issue, too.
A lot of people don't understand what their rights are. A lot of people don't know, you know, what obligations they have, what responsibilities they have, what they should expect from other people or other businesses or from any transaction, and they don't know. Without knowing that, they're going to do things that are, you know, I guess legally they're going to sign away their rights, and you know, it'd be a disadvantage. So I think that's the biggest thing is education.
I'm Nathan Vandiver reporting in Little Rock.
The Arkansas baseball team has been selected as the number 2 seed in the NCAA tournament Houston Regional. Arkansas will face number 3 seed Sam Houston State Friday afternoon in the first round of the NCAA tournament. Arkansas enters the tournament with a 39-19 overall record. The Razorbacks are appearing in the NCAA tournament for the 11th consecutive year and the 25th time in program history. First pitch between the Razorbacks and Sam Houston is set for 1 o'clock Friday afternoon. The other first-round matchup features the host school and top seed in the regional Rice and number 4 seed Prairie View A&M. The regional will continue through Sunday. On the final day of competition at the 2012 NCAA West Preliminary, the number 13 University of Arkansas women's track and field team added 6 national qualifiers. Combined with other efforts during the weekend, the Razorbacks will have 10 entries, 8 individual and 2 relay at the NCAA championships in Des Moines, Iowa. And the 8th-ranked University of Arkansas men's track and field team added 4 national qualifiers Saturday. They'll have a total of 11 entries at the NCAA championships that will be held June 6th through the 9th. And the Frisco Rough Riders used a 4-run first inning to defeat the Northwest Arkansas Naturals 9-6 yesterday in Springdale. The Nats have the day off today, then we'll head to Midland, Texas tomorrow to take on the Rockhounds. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums. It's been a week since Arkansans voted in the May 2012 primary. It was a relatively quiet affair with just one real statewide election and a few spirited legislative races. After the votes were tallied, Roby Brock of TalkBusiness.net sat down with Jason Tolbert of the right-leaning blog The Tolbert Report and Michael Cook from the left-leaning blog Cook's Outlook to discuss what the results may mean for November. Roby first asked Jason Tolbert about the GOP vote.
Jason, tell me, first of all, Tom Cotton emphatically won the 4th District GOP nomination on Tuesday. Should we read too much into one election night, or do you believe that the myth of Tom Cotton just got bigger?
Well, I believe we really saw the introduction of Tom Cotton to Arkansas politics. I think this is going to be the first elected office he gets, but I think he'll be a great congressman for that district. I think he's on his way to victory in the general election. I don't think there's an opponent on the Democratic side that can match him either in his resume as a candidate or in his fundraising ability. And I think he has a bright future in Arkansas politics ahead of him.
Do you sense that Beth Ann Rankin, who finished second, she was the 2010 GOP nominee for that district, do you think she could have done anything differently to alter the outcome of this election? And do you think she still has a political future?
Well, the second question, I think she definitely has a political future. I don't know that she can run for Congress again. She's run for that twice, hasn't been successful either time. So that would be hard for her to do again. But I think if she wants to look at maybe a state-level race, maybe something along the lines of Secretary of State or even the state legislature, I think she certainly has a possibility of that. But running for Congress a third time, that would be tough for her. But I still think we'll see her very involved in the conservative movement here in the state, in the Republican Party. As to what she could have done differently, you know, I'm not sure. Obviously, you could say she could have raised more money. I think she was just outspent by her opponent and had a hard time keeping up with the level he achieved. Normally, the amount she raised would have been plenty for a Republican primary victory in the state. But Cotton just really went PlayStation on her, raising the amount of money that he raised. And she couldn't keep up with that. So, you know, she ran a good campaign. And apart from matching Cotton's funds, it's really the only thing she could have changed.
Cotton's prospects for the fall are considered pretty good due to Q. Byram Hearst's financial and legal troubles and Gene Jeffers' unwillingness to run a modern-day campaign. Is the first district expected to be the only place where Democrats may compete for a congressional seat in your mind?
Well, I'm sure if you were to ask a Democratic consultant, particularly one down in the 4th District, they would answer it quite differently than me. But yes, I think the 1st District is the only district that will be even remotely competitive over on the Democratic side. I think State Senator Jeffries is on his way to winning the runoff. Unless he just really blows it, he'll probably be the nominee down there. And he runs a great grassroots campaign if you're running for the state legislature, but when you're running on a congressional district-wide campaign, that style is just – it would be very difficult for him to win with that style. So unless someone comes in and spends $2 or $3 million nationally down in that district, then I don't think he really has a chance. So I think a lot of the attention will be over in the 1st District where Congressman Crawford is going to be running for reelection.
And he'll either be facing Scott Ellington or Clark Hall. Ellington almost got there on election night without a runoff. Do you think he tips it over, or do you think Hall can come back from 10 points down?
Well, you know, you really have to look at the numbers and think that Ellington has the advantage. What you really saw on election night, since it wasn't the final result, is you saw a very good opinion poll of where the district was on Tuesday. So for Hall to move that, I think he was about 10 or 11 points behind. For him to move that in just 3 weeks' time would be extremely difficult. It could happen. June runoffs are obviously a turnout game. And so if Hall can really move his numbers and get his voters to the poll, he would have a chance to come back. But, you know, just being a few hundred votes shy of making a runoff puts Ellington in a great position to win the runoff. And I think a lot of people were surprised Ellington was so close. I don't think a lot of people expected it to be so close to 50%. I think a runoff was assumed by a lot of people, but just the margin, he was just almost there. You know, he's got to be doing some Wednesday morning quarterbacking of what he could have done differently to have avoided the runoff.
Let's turn to some local races in general. There were a number of Senate and House Republican primaries. The, quote, more conservative, end quote, candidates seem to have won all those races. Are Republicans through with the moderate base of their party in Arkansas?
Well, what I really think you saw, it was a very low turnout primary. And so you saw the party faithful turnout in this election. And you saw that the more motivated voters were the conservative voters. The more moderate type of voters really didn't turn out in such a low turnout primary. And so there's a lot more enthusiasm, I think, in the conservative faction of the Republican Party than there is in the moderate faction of the Republican Party. If it had been a typical November-type turnout, you might have seen a different result. But with the low turnout like it was, they were able to overcome almost every primary. I think just about every, you know, the conservative versus moderate race went to the conservative. And it was kind of interesting as the numbers came in. Some of the moderates were ahead in the early returns. And then when the final numbers came out, and in several races, the conservative, I guess you could say, came back and won. Once we got to about, I guess, 10:30 or 11 o'clock late on Tuesday night, we saw those races turn in the favor of the conservatives.
That's Jason Tolbert of the Tolbert Report talking with Roby Brock from TalkBusiness.net. Roby also talked with Michael Cook of Cook's Outlook about Democratic Party issues raised in the May primary last week.
All right, Michael, let's begin with the first district primary. Scott Ellington surprised a lot of folks with his strong performance. He did not spend a lot of money. What do you attribute his advantage to?
Ellington's real strength was good old-fashioned name recognition. He's the prosecuting attorney up in northeast Arkansas, about six or seven counties is where his district currently covers. So he started off with a lot of people already knowing his name to begin with. I mean, the vast majority of the votes were in his district in that congressional race. And so Clark Hall's problem was he's from the southern part of the district where there are not a lot of votes. Now, Hall was able to put the money together and go up on TV with some good quality television advertising, but he just couldn't overcome Ellington's name recognition. Ellington came within 300-something votes, give or take, of winning the whole thing without a runoff. So what happens now is both Hall and Ellington have to, frankly, in a runoff, just focus on getting their voters to the polls, and that will be a struggle for Hall because there's not a lot of votes in South Arkansas as opposed to Northeast. So Ellington enters into the runoff in the driver's seat. You know, he's now the one to beat in this race. But one caveat I would add to it all is runoffs are always topsy-turvy. You just never know how it could go. You know, if I was going to bet, I would bet on Ellington winning runoff. But runoffs are quirky, so there's always a chance Hall could pull it off.
On to the 4th District. Gene Jeffers ran an old-fashioned shoe leather campaign. He went to pie suppers and festival appearances, not a dime of money on TV, where Q. Byram Hearst did spend a pretty penny. Conventional wisdom says Hearst should have led the ticket, but why did Jeffers do so well?
The same thing in the 4th District race is similar to what's up in the 1st District in that good old-fashioned name recognition. Senator Gene Jeffers has been a state senator in southwest Arkansas for quite a while, but also his brother, State Senator Jimmy Jeffers, is over there in southeast Arkansas. So my point is the Jeffers name is very well known in South Arkansas, and he did very, very well in that. And, of course, he also had state senator in front of his name. So when people went to the polls, they didn't know either one of these candidates. So a lot of the times they just vote for the person with the title in front of the name. So those combination of factors help Gene Jeffers lead the ticket. And also, I think Jeffers is also in a bit of the driver's seat in that he has kind of deep South Arkansas on lockdown. So when it comes time for voting and the runoff, you know, he's also the person to beat. I just wish he would run a more modern campaign. You know, winning a nomination is one thing, but running in a general election against Tom Cotton, who's going to have plenty of money, it's going to be an uphill struggle.
Finally, President Obama, he performed very poorly statewide when you put it in context with an unknown protest candidate, John Wolf, garnering about 42% of the vote against the incumbent. Is the president's strong unpopularity a problem for the Democrats in the fall, and how do they overcome it if it is?
It will be a problem for the candidates for federal office for Congress because they were obviously wanting to have to not be tied to Obama, who's not popular here. But I think once you get down to state rep, state senate level, it goes down to the good old-fashioned all politics is local. And Democratic candidates have got to show that, you know, let themselves be known in the district, show that they're part of the community, that they share the values. I think it always must be remembered that Arkansans love voting against the Democratic nominee for president. Since 1968, the only times we've ever voted for the Democratic nominee for president was twice for Bill Clinton and one time for Jimmy Carter in 1976. Every other time, we've always voted for the Republican candidate. So voting against the Democratic nominee for president is not unusual in Arkansas politics.
Roby Brock talked with Michael Cook of Cook's Outlook last week after the votes had been counted in the Arkansas May primary. Earlier, we heard from Jason Tolbert of the Tolbert Report. Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com and Bank of the Ozarks. More information at BankOzarks.com. and Verizon, offering a wide selection of productivity-enhancing tablets for small business, including the Apple iPad. More information at a Verizon communication store near you or online at vzw.com/smallbusiness. And CEG Partners, using empirical data to better understand your customers' experiences and their loyalties. More information at cegpartners.com. This is Ozarks at Large, the second of the fourth annual KUAF Fulbright Summer Chamber Music Festival concerts is Thursday night, the final day of May. This one is at St. Paul's Episcopal Church Parish Hall. Here to talk to me about it and give us a preview is Stephen Gates, who's one of the organizers of the festival. How are you?
I'm good.
You know better than I who are household names when it comes to composers.
Right.
Okay. Brahms is on the schedule.
Brahms is on this
household
concert.
Name.
Household name.
Okay. Hugo Wolf?
Not so much with chamber music. Okay. If either of us was a singer by trade, we'd know his name.
All right.
He's most famous for German art songs.
Okay. And Arthur Foote?
Arthur Foote is even less well known.
Lived in the 20th century. Born in the 19th, but lived into the 20th.
Right. And he was a lived, worked, died in New England. In Boston area, I think it's possible he may have been associated with Yale at one point. Mm-hmm. But unlike the kind of 20th century music that we associate with more common names like, say, Copland or mm-hmm. Bernstein, there was no real apparent, anyway, attempt on Foote's part to develop a kind of an American style. This was very imitative of his view of the late 19th century German Romanticism, one might say. And so the piece that we're doing, or actually there are two pieces that are related. One is simply called Night Piece, mm-hmm. and it's sounds exactly the way one might expect it to. And the other one is called Scherzo, which just means kind of a light, happy mm-hmm. piece. And they're both, interestingly, written for flute and string quartet. And so we thought that they would be good, actually, in talking with Rhonda Maines, who's our flutist, mm-hmm. about it. She said, well, we had played the Night Piece before, I believe. And she said, well, let's put them together and do it this way. And so they're a lovely pair.
So we'll hear those in the middle. You begin with a piece by Hugo Wolf, who barely but did live into the 20th century mm-hmm. as well. Tell me about Italian Serenade for String Quartet.
Well, it's I was thinking coming over here this morning that the this program really focuses in a way on the string quartet, but the only true string quartet we're playing is this little piece by Hugo Wolf called the Italian Serenade. And it's a one-movement piece that is quite short, maybe 5-7 minutes. And it's a piece that I don't know well. I've never played it before, heard it some. And it's just a delightful, lighthearted – I mean, it fits whatever images we might have of putting together the two words Italian and serenade. It really does a lovely job. It's aptly named. It's light, and I think the tempo marking is – in English, at least, very fast. Mm-hmm. And except for a couple of spots in the middle where there are some recitative-like passages, it just breezes right through and ends. And it's lovely. It's very tricky. And
Tricky
to put together for the four players in the quartet, mainly because it's fast and it has rhythmic intricacies, let's say.
Okay.
But that also makes it an awful lot of fun to work on and I believe fun to listen to.
So that's from Hugo Wolf. We've already talked about the two pieces from Arthur Foote. Then Brahms at the end, quintet for clarinet and strings.
Right. Clarinet and string quartet again. And as probably most people who may be listening to this know we have a wonderful clarinet player whose name I can't pronounce either, but it's close to Nopichai Choltachanta.
Right.
And we have played this piece once before with him quite a few years ago when he was first here. And so we've been looking for a chance when he was in town during our summer festival. We did the Mozart clarinet quintet with him a couple years ago. But in the summer, he's been unavailable because he goes back to Thailand to see family and things. And so this is a chance when he's in town and we're going to be able to do this. And it is, again, as you say, one of the sort of monuments of the chamber music literature. It was written late in Brahms' life. Apparently, Brahms had sort of contemplated giving up composing after he had success with his symphonies and other major works. And then he befriended a clarinet player. And sort of out of that friendship at the end of his life came a trio for clarinet, cello, and piano, and two sonatas for clarinet and piano, and this very, very beautiful clarinet quintet for, as I said, clarinet and string quartet. And it is, as are all these pieces, a little bit on the dark side. You know, there's certainly happy parts, but Brahms seems to have been just wonderful at exploiting that very dark, beautiful, liquid sound of the clarinet.
Somewhat melancholy, perhaps?
Yeah, there's a good word. Yeah. Yeah, all these pieces are that I just mentioned that he wrote for clarinet a little. He probably was feeling melancholy.
Well,
it was very much at the end of his life. And but Brahms was sort of a master of melancholy. You know,
right.
He really did it well.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not dreary by any means. It's just it's a little bit on the dark side, although there are fast, happy parts to it. It's in the traditional four movements that we would expect of a sort of a classicist, even though he lived toward the end of the 19th century.
You mentioned that you have heard the Hugo Wolf Italian Serenade before, but
mm-hmm.
you've never played it.
Correct.
So when you have heard something, you have at least a cursory knowledge, at least with your ears, of what it is. When you open up that score and see it for the first time, are you ever surprised, or do you have a pretty good idea since you've heard it what it's going to look like?
If I've heard it, I have a pretty good idea. There are some pieces that if I looked at the music before I ever heard it, that I might be surprised hearing it.
Really?
It works that direction, especially, of course, in music of the late 19th and early 20th century when it gets very, very chromatic and in a way unpredictable. But I believe Ergin has played this, the Hugo Wolf, so that'll be very, very helpful. And I'm sure I haven't, and I'm pretty sure that our second violinist, who's a graduate student of Ergin's, Catalina Barraza, has not played it. And Molly Sharp will be here for this concert, and I don't know whether she's played it or not. But since we've played the Dvorak Quartet on the first program, it will be, you know, we're kind of getting together as a quartet, and so that'll make the rehearsing a little bit easier to put the whole thing together.
Now, remember that this is the only concert in this week's six-week series which will not be – I'm not going to tell you where it's not because that'll get confusing. I'll tell you where it is. It's going to be at St. Paul's Episcopal Church Parish Hall. That's because there's a lot of activity on campus during the week because of the Walmart shareholders meeting.
Right.
So
right.
Parking is easier this
parking
week.
is really very easy. At St. Paul's, there's plenty of parking, and you can all walk right in on the same level. And it will be at 7:30 Thursday night, as you said. And we always have a reception.
And it's always free.
And it's always free.
Well, that's this Thursday night. It's at 7:30. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Gates is an organizer of the 4th Annual KUAF Fulbright Chamber Music Festival. If you'd like to know more about the festival, you can go to fulbrightsummermusic.uark.
150 years ago, Confederate Brigadier General Thomas Hindman arrived in Arkansas on May 31, 1862, to take command of the military district of the Trans-Mississippi. The diminutive Hindman had been a Helena lawyer and a fire-eating secessionist before the war, and was a combat veteran of Shiloh, as well as being a close friend of Patrick Claiborne. His was a daunting task. "I found here almost nothing," Hindman wrote to a fellow officer. "Nearly everything of value was taken away by General Van Dorn. Nevertheless, Hindman energetically set forth to establish a logistical base and create a new army in the relative wilderness of the Confederacy west of the Mississippi River. He was not joking when he grimly proclaimed, "I have come here to drive out the invaders or perish in the attempt." To learn more about Arkansas history and the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War, visit ArkansasCivilWar150.com. The Arkansas Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission is an agency of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. I'm Mark Crist.
It's Tuesday, May 29th, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us is Becca Martin Brown. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I have a completely random question.
Okay.
That has nothing to do with today.
Okay.
Okay.
Has either one of you seen The New Dark Shadows yet?
No.
Okay. I've been watching The Old Dark Shadows on DVDs borrowed from our lovely library that I can see from here.
Mm-hmm.
It was really bad.
Well, wasn't it live?
For many years,
wasn't it produced, done,
Much
shown
of it,
live?
They would reshoot something. It was shot in New York, like the soap operas were at the time, mm-hmm. and they would reshoot something if it went
horribly awry.
Right. But most of it was live.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And I thought that Jonathan Frid, who played Barnabas Collins, was horribly old at the time, and he might have been 38 or 40.
So, yeah. But it's not. It does not stand the test of time. Is that what you're saying?
Aww.
I think we just move faster now.
Okay.
So if you've seen the movie, let me know, because I need to know if it'll make my head explode. On to the topic at hand, which is the Reading Club sign up all day today at the Bentonville Public Library.
Mm-hmm.
Get your kids out to do something fun for the summer. And tonight is Ozark Poets and Writers Collective with Mary Angelino at 7 o'clock at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville.
All right.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
If I say yarn, you probably don't think social activism. But there is a growing segment of crafters who think you can use materials like yarn to make people think differently about their surroundings. Ozarks at Large's Meredith Martin Motes explains what a yarn bomb is and how crafting can help build communities.
Can you attach things to your bags?
Sure.
We have a lot of flowers and pom-poms.
Yeah.
Make it happen.
Downtown Little Rock is crowded with book lovers of all varieties for the annual Arkansas Literary Fest. Among the presenters is Gail Zucker, co-author and photographer of the book Craft Activism, People, Ideas, and Projects from the New Community of Handmade and How You Can Join In. After a short presentation, Gail, along with librarian and fellow knitter Patrice O'Donohue, break out a large collection of recycled knitted and crocheted items to yarn bomb the area near the library. Yarn bombing is often referred to as knit graffiti, and on this sunny afternoon, participants secure knitted or crocheted items to light posts, benches, and other non-organic urban landmarks. The black metal and the gray concrete suddenly become alive with bright red and blue, soft tactile shades of green and pink, fuzzy yellows and oranges, all discarded handcrafts taking on a new life. Because Little Rock is a green city, participants also hang yarn from the shrubbery and the trees. The yarn pom-poms almost look as if they're growing from the branches. Pretty soon, more and more people were stopping by and joining in, both adults and children, and it wasn't long before the yarn bombing group had nearly doubled. After the yarn bombing was complete, I sat down and spoke with Gail about her book, which features profiles of the women and organizations behind the new generation of craft activism. And we talked about some of her thoughts on the power of crafting to build and strengthen communities.
I think humans want to connect, and you just wouldn't walk up to a stranger and start talking, even if you were both in the library on the same day. But when you give somebody something to do, it's like an excuse to start talking. And then what was so cool is, I mean, we had everything from, you know, moms and little kids. We had a bunch of teenagers who joined in. One of them said, "I don't want to do flowers," so she made, like, recycled sweater Pac-Mans. And a couple of the boys, and these were guys who were probably, don't know, they're probably 14 years old, 14, 15 years old. And they said, you know, we could put things on here that aren't flowers, too. Like, they just got into it. It's just a really good community builder.
Gil has a background in photojournalism, and this is the second book she's co-authored with Joan Tapper. Their first was Sheer Spirit, 10 Fiber Farms, 20 Patterns, and Miles of Yarn, and it profiled the yarn-making community. This most recent book is part pattern book, part artist profile, and part how-to guide to becoming active in the crafting community. Broken up into five sections, including crafting a statement, redrafting the past, crafting for a cause, crafting to recycle, renew, and reuse, and crafting to create a community, you can't look at this book and not want to start making something new.
Our editor had given us the mission to make sure that there was like an action aspect so that when you were reading something, if you were excited, you could spring into action. And it became a little bit of a joke, our action sidebars. So we wanted to make sure that the crafts we included were things that people could fairly easily try without having to go out and buy a bunch of specialized equipment or use something that was toxic or have to pay a lot of money to have access to some kind of special welding tool.
The crafter profiles range from a guitar player who gave up music for embroidery, changing the face of the Austin art scene in the process, to a woman who knits and displays elaborate animal patterns as fine art, calling attention to endangered species, to Carolyn Mazlumi and the Women of Color Quilters Network.
And she had put out the call for this exhibit to women who had... She asked for people not just to have quilts that were about Obama's election or an inauguration, but about anything about civil rights, about the whole civil rights movement, and then culminating in Obama's inauguration. So when I went to go photograph her, the exhibit had been moved to the Wilberforce Museum, which is actually part of the Smithsonian, and I think it's the Civil Rights Museum in Wilberforce, Ohio. And she asked a group of women who were not too far away to come and meet together. One of the women there was Dr. Cleota Lewis, who was a quilter. She was in her 90s. She was wearing this fabulous outfit that was all crazy quilted and just fabulous. I mean, everything, and even her shoes were crazy quilted, and she makes all her own clothes that way. She had a necklace that was made of all kinds of charms that had meaning to her. There was, like, charms that had said NAACP. There were things that were from the Civil Rights Movement or people she admired or sayings, places she had been. And she told me that in every piece she does, whether it's a quilt that gets hung on a wall or if it's her clothing, there is a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of faded pink and white gingham. And that gingham came from an apron that had been her grandmother's, and her grandmother had been a slave. So, I mean, to me, that was so moving. And for everybody who is in the book, who is a craft activist, who really wears their message on their sleeve and puts their word out there, this was equally as strong a message to me that she very quietly was carrying this thing in her craft.
Throughout the book, the profiled crafters touch on topics of human rights and how crafting can channel the ongoing struggle, both embracing and reinventing the skills of the past to work toward the future, and in the process, creating new symbols for a younger generation.
Like, for instance, we kept on finding early on an interest in aprons, and I kept on saying to Joan, I think we should have aprons in here. And she'd be like, aprons? Oh, no, that's crazy. Why would one have aprons in here? And Joan said, I wouldn't go near an apron in my own life ever. You know, to me, an apron's a symbol of, like, what I, you know, really didn't want to do when I grew up. And then I was saying, well, Joan, Joan's a few years older than I am, and I guess I grew up at a time when I was sort of, I guess, second wave feminism. So women my age didn't wear aprons, and we didn't teach our kids to wear aprons, and we didn't emphasize cooking and sewing maybe to our kids as they were growing up as being important things to learn as a girl. And so those girls are now in their 20s and wishing that they kind of had this skill set, and how cool it is to connect to doing what used to be called domestic arts. But the interesting spin on it now in this sort of third wave feminism is it's a very empowering thing to know how to make things. And I think it's whether you're a man or a woman.
While some of the crafters featured in the book work with ancient materials like cotton and wool, There are also artists like Virginia Fleck, who use modern materials to explore concepts of waste.
She lives in Austin, and she said it would really bug her to go to like a big box store. And she said, who are these people who buy things, and then when they get to their car, they take them out of the bag, and they somehow throw the bag on the ground, and it's blowing through this great big parking lot. And she'd go pick up the bags and started looking at all the different colors on them and the sayings and thinking, what can I make with them? And she started to do some sort of sculptural art where they were inflated. And then she realized she could just cut them up and make mandalas with them and just kind of repurpose them. And it's more than just using it as a material. She also looks at the message, like the more hidden message of like, this is something you threw away, but I'm making it into art now.
Modern crafting evokes and critiques social messages, furthers causes, defines arts, and builds bridges between generations. And it's also generating new economies, allowing many crafters to use online sales as a way to create a modern cottage industry of sorts.
What do you think? Do you like my edition?
I love your edition. I think you should keep going.
Back at the yarn bombing outside the library, participants chat about their yarn graffiti, which is by now covering all the benches, bushes, and light poles. Even my son's stroller was yarn bombed with some pink yarn pom-poms when they came by with their father to have a look. It's truly an intergenerational activity. Today's group has included teenagers, women, and their young children, even random middle-aged passers-by. Working on this book, Gail says, reaffirmed her love for the potentially revolutionizing power of art and crafting.
It confirmed everything I believed about the power of handmade, because in taking part in yarn bombings or connecting with people when I travel, and people send me emails about, oh, I wanted you to know about this project we did in our community. And that's kind of the power of creating community where you don't think you're going to by making something together.
You can find the book and learn more about Gail and Joan's work in documenting the world of craft activism at their blog, craftactivism.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Meredith Martin-Motes.
Meredith Martin-Motes is a reporter for Ozarks at Large. She's also a newspaper columnist for newspapers in Russellville and Yell County and a blogger. You can read more by her at the blog BoiledDownJuice.com. BoiledDownJuice.com. In just a couple of weeks, several area high school seniors-to-be will be making their way to Central Arkansas for the annual Governor's School session. The multi-week program has been a staple of the Arkansas summertime for more than 30 years. Becca Hall from our partner station KUAR has this story on how the school has affected the lives of students and teachers.
On June 10th, 400 rising seniors from all over Arkansas will flock to the Hendricks College campus to begin their four-week stay for the 33rd Arkansas Governor School Program. Arkansas Governor School is a non-credit residential program for the gifted and talented youth of the state. Students who are accepted to the program do not pay any fee to attend, and Director Lyle Rupert says the state of Arkansas is to thank for this.
This is an investment of taxpayer dollars, no doubt about that, but it's an investment for the future because it's a way to develop the youth of Arkansas into the future leaders of Arkansas. And so I have appreciation for Governor Beebe, for the legislators and the Department of Education, because they're the ones that are prioritizing this money for this very type of program.
The Governor's School program is one that challenges its participants. Students attend in one of eight core areas: choral music, drama, English and language arts, instrumental music, mathematics, natural science, social science, or visual arts. Aside from their core class, each student participates in an Area 2 class for general conceptual development and an Area 3 class for personal and social development. Central High School senior Mary Catherine Barker, a Governor School alumnus, says that in all areas, the student is encouraged to think and explore.
At Governor School, it's just really an open environment where any point of view is accepted, and just like, you know, thinking outside the box, you know, that's always encouraged. And so any point of view is welcome. And even if you don't necessarily agree on something, it's never like a hostile, you know, there's never one thing that's right and one thing that's wrong.
Students from all across Arkansas attend Governor School after completing the application process. The application consists of several open response questions for the student, the attachment of their transcript, and an essay. Director Lyle Rupert says that students selected are not perfect, but rather have an apparent love for learning and a motivation to do so.
It's not like every student who comes is a straight A student, or every student who comes has a 5 trillion on their ACT or whatever. We look for a good broad spectrum of our students who have this interest in learning, this interest in discussing, gifted and talented type student.
The environment at Arkansas Governor School is one that encourages a sense of community. Governor School students have the run of the Hendricks College campus for over a month, and this seclusion helps develop the close bonds that are formed during that time. Friendships made at the program are often the ones that stay with alumni for a lifetime, even as students go their separate ways into the world. Mary Catherine Barker, an alumnus of the 2011 session, says that the program makes one feel secure and comfortable throughout those 4 weeks.
Something about being there, it's kind of being away from the real world for like 4 weeks out of your summer. It's you're in that campus, and it's just you and your friends, like these relationships that you form, and something about it is just like such a safe feeling, and I don't know, somehow that just turns into, you just feel like these people that you meet there are the kinds of people that you know that you can trust and you feel like you can tell anything to them.
Students who participate in Arkansas Governor's School do a lot of learning in a very short amount of time. The program has fluctuated from being 6 weeks long for 30 years to being 4 weeks long for the past 2 years and this summer. And in the summer of 2013, the program moves back to its original 6-week length. Despite the changes in length over time, Rupert says that alumni consistently have the same things to say about their experiences.
Here are a few things that we hear over and over from our students. Number one, they get to know other gifted and talented students from around the state. And so they realize there are a lot of people just like them. There are a lot of people who love to learn, love to express opinions, listen to others' opinions, share ideas, you know, be creative. And so they kind of learn they're not alone, right? There's a lot of people around the state that share those same values that they do. Students learn and develop their critical thinking skills. And so maybe they can think a little bit more deeply about issues that they want to discuss with people. They learn how to communicate those issues with each other, so they learn how to be good listeners as well as good speakers about their own beliefs.
During Governor School, Hendricks College runs rampant with some of the brightest minds in the state, learning from each other, from their teachers, from their residence hall directors, and most importantly, they learn more about themselves. Identities are developed and become as firm and true as the friendships that are developed simultaneously. This program has changed lives for 33 years and will continue to change them for many years to come. I'm Becca Hall.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Fort Smith Public Library will host a summer reading kickoff celebration May 31st. That's Wednesday. Also, a beginning genealogy class that day begins as well. For more information on events that take place at the Fort Smith Public Library, you can go online to fortsmithlibrary.org. And just down the road, the Fort Smith Museum of History will host a book signing with Jerry Akins June 2nd, Saturday, from 1 until 3 in the afternoon. Jerry has written Hanging Times in Fort Smith, A History of Executions in Judge Parker's Court. The event is free. It's open to the public. If you'd like more information, 783-7841.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 29th of May, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who said the whole modern world has divided itself into conservatives and progressives. The business of progressives is to go on making mistakes. The business of the conservatives is to prevent the mistakes from being corrected. G.K. Chesterton, born London, 1874. He was 6'4" tall, nearly 300 pounds, author of the popular Father Brown detective stories. It was on this day, 1914, Edgar Lee Masters published the first poem of what would later be the Spoon River Anthology. Masters was a lawyer in Chicago, began writing short poems about the townspeople of Spoon River, a town that he based on his hometown of Lewiston, Illinois. He was afraid the people in Lewiston would take offense, so he published all of his poems individually and then as a book under the pseudonym Webster Ford. And it was an immediate commercial success, became one of the best-selling books of poetry in American history. And it's the birthday of the writer known as Max Brand. He was born in Seattle, 1892, Frederick Faust, author of many thrillers and melodramas, romances, but it was the Western that he was famous for, best known for his novel Destry Rides Again. During the Great Depression, one of the highest-paid pulp fiction writers in America, writing a full-length novel every week, earning about $100,000 a year. He used the pseudonyms because after World War I, he was afraid that Americans wouldn't want to read books written by a man with a German last name, Faust. When World War II began, he got himself posted as a correspondent for Harper's Magazine. He was sent to the front lines and later died of a shrapnel wound in Italy among soldiers who had grown up reading his stories. Here's a poem for today by Mark Halliday, Key to the Highway. I remember riding somewhere in a fast car with my brother and his friend Jack Brooks, and we were listening to Layla and other love songs by Derek and the Dominoes. The night was dark, dark, all along the highway. Jack Brooks was a pretty funny guy, and I was delighted by the comradely interplay between him and my brother, but I tried not to show it for fear of inhibiting them. I tried to be reserved and maintain a certain dignity appropriate to my age, older by 4 years. They knew the Dominoes album well, having played the cassette many times, and they knew how much they liked it. As we rode on in the dark, I felt the music was, after all, wonderful, and I said so with as much dignity as possible. "That's right," said my brother. "You're getting smarter," said Jack. We were listening to Bell Bottom Blues at that moment. Later, we were listening to Key to the Highway, and I remember how my brother said, "Yeah, yeah," and Jack sang one of the lines in a way that made me laugh. I am upset by the fact that that night is so absolutely gone. No, upset is too strong, or is it? But that night is so obscure. Until now, I may not have thought of that ride once in 8 years, and this obscurity troubles me. Death is going to defeat us all so easily. Jack Brooks is in Florida, I believe, and I may never see him again, which is more or less all right with me. He and my brother lost touch some years ago. I wonder where we were going that night. I don't know, but it seemed as if we had the key to the highway. A poem by Mark Halliday, Key to the Highway, from Little Star, published by William Morrow and Company, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Nook, Simple Touch with Glow Light by Barnes & Noble. Designed for bedtime reading, Glow Light offers paper-like reading with the lights on or off. Available at neighborhood Barnes & Noble stores or Nook.com. Produced by Nick Vedder, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for KUAF comes from Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, hosting American Encounters, Thomas Cole, and the Narrative Landscape through August 13th. The exhibit features six paintings of distinctive style, influences, and impact on other American artists. The exhibition is part of a multi-year collaboration with Crystal Bridges, the Louvre, and others. More information available online at crystalbridges.org. KUAF is proud to co-sponsor Walton Arts Center's Artisphere, Arkansas's Arts and Nature Festival, featuring the Artisphere Festival Orchestra June 16th through the 22nd. Under the music direction of Corrado Riveras, the orchestra will play works by Elgar, Walton, Bartok, as well as Brahms Symphony No. 1. Information and an event schedule available online at artisphearfestival.org. This is KUAF Public Radio 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, West Fork. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back tomorrow at noon with another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. Have a great Tuesday. And we'll end today's show with a bit of music from Danny Elfman, the Oscar-nominated and Grammy-winning composer, is best known for his film and TV scores and themes. He was also a member of the band Oingo Boingo for several years. He turns 59 today.